the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told lawmakers Tuesday the International Criminal Court's announcement that it's seeking an arrest warrant for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu endangers hopes for a ceasefire in Gaza. His testimony comes as progressives criticize the Biden administration over its support for Israel. VOA's Catherine Gibson tells us the move drew bipartisan criticism in Washington.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
The shameful equivalence implied between Hamas and the leadership of Israel, I think that only complicates the prospects for getting such an agreement. We'll continue to forge ahead to do that, but that decision, as you said, on so many levels, is totally wrongheaded.
Democratic Senator Tim Kaine.
A prosecutor making a recommendation, I think, is not worth the attention this is getting.
Blinken told lawmakers the U.S. has warned Israel its offensive in the region could be deeply harmful to civilians. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
Protesters interrupted U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken as he began offering testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee Friday.
I was saying, the People's Republic of China.
Blinken reiterated the support of President Joe Biden's administration for Israel, but insisted it was focused on easing the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Israel shut down and seizure of an Associated Press video camera that provided a live glimpse into Gaza, alarmed many journalists who worried Tuesday about wider implications for coverage of war largely fought out in the world's sight to begin with. This is VOA News. Thousands of mourners descended on the Iranian city of Tabriz on Tuesday to mourn President Ibrahim Raisi after he was killed in a helicopter crash near the Azerbaijan border on Sunday, along with his foreign minister and seven others. Reuters correspondent Lauren Anthony.
State TV broadcast images showing many dressed in black, crowding a truck covered in white flowers, which carried caskets wrapped in Iran's national flag. Despite the turnout, some insiders see a stark contrast in public grief compared to past commemorations for the deaths of other senior figures in the Islamic Republic's 45-year history. Iran proclaimed 5 days of mourning for Raisi, but there was little of the emotional rhetoric that accompanied the death of Qasem Soleimani, a senior commander of Iran's elite Revolutionary Guards, killed by a U.S. missile in 2020 in Iraq. His funeral drew huge crowds of mourners, weeping with sorrow and rage.
Singapore. The airline says that one of its flights hit severe turbulence over the Indian Ocean and descended 6,000 feet in about 3 minutes. Authorities say a British man died, possibly after a heart attack, and several people were severely injured. The flight from London to Singapore was diverted to Bangkok. Details of the weather at the time over the sea near Myanmar have not been described. One official says the sudden descent occurred as passengers were being served food. The passenger says the seatbelt sign was on, but crew members did not have time to take their seats. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports from court on the jury that will decide Donald Trump's fate, after closing arguments, which are expected next Tuesday.
The jury in Donald Trump's hush money trial is made up of 18 Manhattan residents. The main jury includes 7 men and 5 women. There are also 6 alternate jurors who have been in court listening to the testimony but won't join in the deliberations unless one of the main jurors needs to drop out or is removed. The jury represents a diverse cross-section of Manhattanites and come from various professional backgrounds, including a sales professional, a software engineer, a security engineer, a teacher, a speech therapist, multiple lawyers, an investment banker, and a retired wealth manager. At criminal court in Manhattan, I'm Julie Walker.
Congo's army spokesman has released the name of a third American involved in a foiled coup in Kinshasa. Brigadier General Sylvain Nkingi told the Associated Press the third American was Taylor Thompson. It was not immediately clear whether Thompson was among those arrested or killed Sunday morning following the attack on the palace and another on the residence of a close ally of President Felix Tshisekedi. The leader of the plot, Christian Malanga, was killed in a shootout at the palace after resisting arrest. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa. 104th of America. I'm Jan Barthi in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The White House to welcome Kenyan President William Ruto.
The Kenya-U.S. partnership has really grown from a regionally focused one to a globally focused one, so we've been really pleased the way the Kenyans have stepped up to play leadership beyond their region.
The UN says tens of thousands of Somalis are internally displaced, primarily due to insecurity and conflict. Liberia begins repatriating its citizens from Ghana. Meanwhile, President Joseph Boakai says he does not support an increase in the price of rice in Liberia. Women in Botswana watch from the sidelines as the country prepares for elections.
While statistically Botswana women make more than 50% of the voters, women's representation in elected positions remain very low.
And Biden and Trump compete for women's vote. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The White House will roll out the red carpet for the first African leader to be hosted for a state visit since 2008. Kenyan President William Ruto will get a lavish state dinner and some deals, the White House has said. But also on the table are Nairobi's aim to leverage Washington's assistance and influence after Kenya offered to send a peacekeeping force to Haiti. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
White House gave VOA its three reasons for choosing Kenya's president to break the nearly 16-year drought during which no African leader has been honored with a state visit. These include the two governments' shared democratic convictions and their like-minded approach in leveraging the private sector. The primary reason, the administration's new top Africa policymaker told VOA, is Kenya's recent decision to assert itself globally by offering 1,000 security officers for Haiti. Frances Brown is Senior Director for African Affairs at the National Security Council. She sat down with VOA this week for her first media interview since taking the job earlier this month.
We chose Kenya for a few reasons. Number one is the Kenya-U.S. partnership has really grown from a regionally focused one to a globally focused one. So we've been really pleased the way the Kenyans have stepped up to play leadership beyond their region.
Analysts say a state visit is a big deal. Cameron Hudson is a senior fellow in the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
It is the highest diplomatic honor that our president can bestow. Is typically an indicator of a very close and important bilateral relationship. And so elevating Kenya to the level of, let's say, a Japan, which was the most recent country to have a state visit, I think is symbolic, and it's important for all the reasons that I just described, as far as Kenya being on a level that we would give it the same privileges as one of our oldest and longest security partners.
Brown said the administration aims to use the visit to reach agreements in areas like technology, climate management, debt relief, and health. And on the Haiti security mission, Washington has signaled its approval with a $300 million pledge of support. Brown again.
We've been working really closely with them. As you may know, there's been planning underway for a number of months. It's included policing experts from around the world working to develop a concept of operations. Kenya's not going it alone.
Kenyan President William Ruto, on his first stop in Atlanta, said he prioritized the need for American help in restructuring the debts of African nations, many of them to China, the world's largest creditor. But human rights advocates in Nairobi told VOA they hope American leadership will also raise concerns over abuses by Kenyan police, who are taking the lead in the Haiti mission. They also shared fears around proposed legislation they say threatens sexual minorities and a decline in media freedoms. Irungu Houghton is Executive Director for Amnesty International Kenya.
We, first of all, see this as a really excellent opportunity to focus on governance, human rights, and the rule of law for many reasons. Both the United States and Kenya are nations that have projected themselves as essentially nations that believe in these values, and the state dinner is an opportunity really to focus on that.
All this drama playing on this stage on Thursday. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
As Botswana prepares for general elections later this year, the number of women running for office remains low. In the last general election, only 5% of women were elected to the National Assembly. Kundise Dube reports from Harborini.
Political parties have finalized their list of candidates for the 2024 general election scheduled in October, and the majority of contestants are male. In the ruling Botswana Democratic Party, BDP, out of nearly 200 candidates for the National Assembly, only 20 are women. Gender activist Pamela Dube says the situation is concerning, especially given how few women were elected in 2019.
The pertaining state of affairs in women's political participation in Botswana is saddening. While statistically Botswana women make more than 50% of the voters, women's representation in elected positions remain very low. I have serious doubt that we'll see an improvement in the upcoming October elections.
Botswana falls short of the framework established by the regional bloc, the Southern Africa Development Community, for achieving gender parity. The group's policy advocates equal representation in political and decision-making positions. Dube says the governing BDP should create gender quotas in order to push for legislated seat allocation.
Botswana has no such laws or even constitutional provisions. It is even said that the Constitutional Review Bill, which is before Parliament, is silent in this regard.
Spokesperson for opposition coalition the Umbrella for Democratic Change, UDC, Moeti Moasa, says the country's electoral laws do not favor women. Botswana uses the first-past-the-post system, where voters choose a single candidate as opposed to a list.
You cannot expect the very same setup or situation that is patriarchal, conservative, to allow women to rise and occupy positions of authority or influence in society. So our position is that we need to have a mixed system which will have the current first past the post and also the list system. If you look at the countries that have list system, you will realize that the women in those countries are much more empowered.
Maputo-based Women in Political Participation, WPP Programs Officer Sifiso Sami Dube, says Botswana should have amended its electoral laws under a recent constitutional review process.
There is a need to handhold the women in political leadership from the time they are campaigning or they are thinking about campaigning to the time they will be campaigning, to the time they will be in elections, to the time they will be in political leadership positions. Because once in when they are in the political offices, it's quite cold in there. There is need for them to be continuously motivated.
While Botswana struggles to get more women in politics, countries like Angola, Mozambique, Namibia, South Africa, Tanzania, and Zimbabwe have more than 30% women representation in upper and lower houses of parliament. Nkondisi Dube, VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
More than 140,000 people have been internally displaced in Somalia over the past 4 months, primarily due to insecurity and conflict, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR. The UN Refugee Agency says Somalia was hosting 39,025 refugees and asylum seekers as of April 30, among whom 66% are women and children. For more on the situation in Somalia, viewers Douglas Mpuga reached Abdi Ismail Samata, a professor at the University of Minnesota and a senator in the Somali parliament.
The problem in this country is it has land, it has people, but it does not have an authority that's conscientious enough to take care of the people and conscientious enough to organize itself such that these ecological climatic things are predictable to some degree. And therefore, they can make plans for it, effective plans, so there are contingencies in place. But such a government doesn't exist, unfortunately, across the landscape. And consequently, ordinary people who are looking for guidance, who are looking for help to organize themselves so that they can put preventive measures in place, don't have sort of a partner in the form of government.
So even if there was international help, given that there is some fighting in some areas, would the government be able to assist those who are displaced?
Yeah, I mean, they will pretend that they are trying to help. But, you know, Somalia is a semi-arid country, climatically speaking. And so the two rivers, the flooding season is predictable. The droughts are predictable. Now we have enough time for the world to be able to do that. And so two things. One, the government has not been able over the last 10 or more years to take control over the entire territory of the country. And consequently, it doesn't have the authority and the power to quell conflict where that arises. So it may be able to help in here and there, but not in a large swath of the country. And so the international community, to some degree, would have made this country incredibly dependent on assistance of that kind. I've never really quite challenged the government before the droughts come, before the rains come, before the floods come. So it's a population in these places have become perpetual victims, both of neglect on the part of the government, but also on the part of nature comes. And they have not been able, the population has not been able to organize itself in any manner that's of consequence in the prevention of these disasters. So it's an incredible tragedy, if I may say so.
And interestingly, Somalia, according to the same report, is hosting thousands of refugees from Ethiopia, from Yemen and elsewhere. Does that complicate the situation even more?
It's rather incredible to imagine how terrible places like Yemen are to push their people to come to Somalia, which is also a very desperate. Somalis are unable to put Humpty Dumpty together to take care of themselves and need international help, or have been dependent on the international help for the last 30 plus years. So that certainly compounds populations who move as refugees from Ethiopia and from Yemen and somewhere else, compound the problem, but they really are not a big burden to the population because the population sees themselves in the lives of these people. Somalis fled their country, so they welcome those who are fleeing violence and whatnot. And I don't think they really compound the problem that much.
Abdi Ismail Samata is a professor at the University of Minnesota and a senator in the Somali parliament. He spoke with VOA's Douglas Mpuga from the Somali capital, Mogadishu. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I am James Butte, Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 22nd. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Liberian President Joseph Boakai says he does not support an increase in the price of rice. As Denise Nipson reports from Monrovia, the president said this Tuesday after a meeting with his commerce minister and rice importers.
On Monday, the Minister of Commerce and Industry, Ami Modak, told the country that the price of rice has been increased from U.S. $16 to U.S. $18.50 following a demand for rice importers. Moda said the price rise was based on a 20% surcharge on rice imported by local Indian importers.
On Friday, we received, or Thursday, we received another letter from the rice importers citing all the figure sellers, and they informed us that they have made up to what we negotiated. They have a stock of rice that have arrived, a major stock of rice, but due to the cost of all that they have factored in, they can't afford to sell at the 16.75 that we put it down to.
Eugene Namwe is the chairman of the Strategic Committee of the Opposition Coalition for Democratic Change, CDC. He told VOA the increment was made due to the lack of political will to do the right thing.
It's quite unfortunate because this could have easily been avoided had the government implemented the right cocktail of measures, of policy measures, to ensure that it's available and affordable. Instead, the government has just resorted to political statements instead of addressing the core issue, which is to identify the underlying causes of the problem and then fix it by implementing the right policies and executing the right measures, just as was done over the past 6 years. You know, when there is a crisis with such a commodity that is not produced in the country, you adjust your tariff, you ensure if there's a need to provide subsidies.
Retailer Martin Conley explains that the vendors were already charging the new price of U.S. $18.50.
It started from last week, Thursday evening. So we go buy rest,
been limited. We got 300 beds. They say they can only say 50 beds. So we start wondering why is it happening. We know there's a bed there. We're not supposed to increase the press. So in that, just to know that yesterday evening, from when we go in the morning, maybe if they see the first 50 person, they tell you still close. But just to know yesterday now, start buying red, 18 hours, 50 cents, they say that the press is going to come and sell it at 19 hours.
Some Liberians say President Boakai's rejection of a price hike is reassuring. For VOA's Daybreak Africa, I'm Denise Nipson in Monrovia, Liberia.
Liberia has begun repatriating its citizens from Ghana on buses. The first group of 700 is expected to arrive in Liberia today, Wednesday. Thousands of Liberians who fled their country's civil war in the early 1990s, have been living at the Bujumbura refugee camp in Ghana. In 2010, the Ghanaian Refugee Board reached an agreement with the UNHCR to close the camp. In March 2024, authorities began demolishing structures in the camp. Denise Guyon is the president of the Bujumbura camp. He tells me that the Liberian government arranged for buses to transport the refugees.
July 2 weeks, the Liberian government came to Bujumbura, and on Sunday they launched a repatriation of those who are willing to go back to Liberia. So the process kicked out. Today, the first batch will be taking 770 persons straight to Banga. That's the latest development that we have. And those who are going to the southeast, they are not going today. The only people that are going are those that are going to Neuma, Bon, Maigibi, Mosorado, Bomen, Kedmao, Bapolus, and Lofa.
So did you say the Liberian government provided transportation and money?
They provided transportation for the people to go. And they told us clearly that those that are going, they don't have anything to give them. But if they get there, the government will assess them and know their needs.
Do these people who are returning, do they know where they came from when they first came to Ghana? Do they know which county of Liberia they came from?
Yes, some know the county they came from, and some don't even know where they come from. And some are even born here, and some even lost their parents here. So we were able to tell the Liberian government all of this thing, and they are aware of these people. So as we speak, they promise all that they're going to take care of them good and integrate them in the Liberian society.
The last time we spoke, some demolition was taking place in the refugee camp. What has happened since then?
So they have demolished the entire camp. The 142 acres of land have been demolished. And our people are still sleeping outside, like I told you the other side. People are in the school building. People are outside on a tent. That's the only thing that are happening. There will no more camp again. They are demolished everywhere. Nowhere is on the camp now that you have a structure. They are demolished all. So as we speak, people are living in the school building for the past 4 months. And people are outside. People are in some of the few churches that remain.
Mr. Guyon, you personally, do you plan to return to Liberia?
Yeah, I plan to return to Liberia. I will make sure that everybody leaves and they get back home, and I will be the last person living in this place. Because I don't want to leave anybody in any problem here. So I'm negotiating with the Liberian government to make sure that we take all of our people who are stranded here.
You say the first group is leaving when?
Oh, leaving today. I will even accompany them up to the border and come back in the night.
And how are they going? By road?
Yeah, by road. Charter buses through La Côte d'Ivoire, Liberia.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Guyon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dennis Guyon is the president of the Bujumbura refugee camp, housing thousands of Liberians in Ghana. He was speaking with us from Accra. The medical charity Doctors Without Borders said Tuesday that at least 85 people have died in a single hospital in the Darfur city of El Fasher since fighting ignited between Sudan's warring parties on May 10th. On Monday alone, 9 of 60 casualties received at Southern Hospital, El Fasher's only remaining medical facility, had died of their wounds, said Claire Nicolide, head of the charity's Sudan Emergency Program. She is quoted by the French news agency as saying that in the period since the fighting erupted in the North Darfur state capital, the hospital had received 707 casualties and 85 have passed away. Gunmen on motorbikes killed up to 40 people while torching houses during an attack on a mining village in central Nigeria, officials and residents said on Tuesday. It's the latest violence to hit a region troubled by resource disputes and intercommunal strife. According to the French news agency AFP, the attack late Monday took place in Plateau State, where nearly 200 people had been killed last December in raids on mostly Christian villages. The Plateau State Commissioner for Information told AFP that armed men invaded Zurak mining community in Wase district in the evening, shooting sporadically at residents and torching houses. Women voters are more than half of the U.S. electorate. VOA correspondent Cass Stearns reports on what presidential candidates Joe Biden and Donald Trump are doing to win women's votes.
Much of this presidential campaign's focus on women voters is centered on abortion laws and reproductive rights. But American women care about more than just abortion, and the campaigns are reaching out on broader issues, including the economy, health care, and crime. In Minnesota, voter Rebecca Jensen says President Joe Biden deserves credit for making what she says are the right decisions.
I think things about the environment are very important. I think the economy is important, and health care. I'm a nurse, and so I still see COVID at work frequently. And people keep saying, we're post-pandemic, but we're really not. We're still in the midst of it. So I just think that having somebody that believes in science in the White House is a good thing.
In Nevada, voter Julie Bembe wants a second term for Donald Trump.
He was good for the economy. There was no war. There was harmony. There was peace. We were all working. The gas prices were normal. I mean, he was an amazing man. He loves his country. He's a good person. He raised a good family. And we're going to get him back.
Biden is targeting women voters with a White House initiative on women's health research.
Think of all the breakthroughs we've made in medicine across the board, but women have not been the focus. Research has been taking much too long to get to y'all.
When you say to a family that if you come, we're going to break you up, they don't come.
The Biden campaign released a Mother's Day social media ad attacking Trump's policy of separating immigrant families, telling voters to, quote, do the moms in your life a favor, stop Trump. Trump told a meeting of conservative Christian women that he'll bring peace to Europe.
Before I even arrive at the Oval Office, shortly after I win the presidency, I will have the horrible war between Russia and Ukraine settled.
Trump is also working to appeal to women voters with get tough messages on crime and immigration.
I think I do great with the suburban housewives because they want to remain safe. But they loot the jewelry, they take their purses, electronics, watches, all of their cash, and the people come back and they say, what happened? If you don't want illegal alien criminals crawling through your windows and ransacking your drawers, then you must vote for the fact that we have to throw crooked Joe Biden out as fast as possible, the damage he can do.
The Center for American Women in Politics says more women have voted than men in every U.S. presidential election since 1980. In their 2020 race, Pew Research data says Biden won the women's vote by 11 percentage points over Trump. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
And that's it for this Wednesday, May 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming on board with us this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Buckley, Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.
Friday at 9 p.m. UTC time with your pilot, Roger Moon, to listen to the RM Show, where you can respond to our question of the week, get some entertainment news, and enjoy some great music. It's all happening at VOA Africa. God bless. Peace, Africa.